better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spearco with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, August the 29th. This is episode 3,555 of the Survival Podcast, and I've got a great one for you today because you know what it is. It's Thursday. Time for the Expert Council Q&A show for the week. We've got a big lineup for you today, some well-knowns, some new faces, and some only heard from occasionally people all in one today. Really great variety of stuff we're going to talk about. We'll lead off, as always, with Dr. Ron Paul and Chris Rossini and the Liberty Highlights of the Week from the Ron Paul Liberty Report. They're going to do a segment called Democracy in and of Itself Does Not Equal Freedom. I could not agree more. Matt Hill, yeah, he's not really an expert council member, but he might be soon. We've had enough stuff come for him, and he just throws it right back to us. I did ask him today if he wanted to be a permanent member. We'll see what he says. But we had a couple questions come in. He put them together for us in a single segment. One on running free GPT on Start 9, and another on submitting apps to the Start 9 marketplace. So you can actually develop Start 9 compatible applications and submit them to Start 9, and Matt will tell you how to do that, along with running free GPT. Michael Melito, new council member, who takes your questions on guns and firearms and hunting and things like that, will talk about choosing a thermal optic for predator hunting and the problem of misidentification and not wanting to do something like, oh, I don't know, you're out on your ranch and you're like, I got a coyote problem, and oh, there's the coyote in the thermal scope, and bang, and the next thing you know, you've killed your neighbor's border collie. You don't want to do that. I'll tell a little story of my own of why this is important, and he gave a perfect answer to this question. It's brief, but perfect. Andy McCann will talk about exercising today to avoid injuries as we age. Jesse Markowitz, we'll talk about preventing and detecting hacks on your Bitcoin wallet or computer. Sean Mills will talk about backup power, or really battery power, for a mobile Starlink situation. Ken Daniels will talk about making blackberry-infused vodka and blackberry-infused other things. And I will talk about self-defense for a single woman and why I do not recommend a knife for this. A person wrote the question in for me on behalf of this gal, asked for a knife recommendation. I'll talk a little bit about what knives can and can't do for you, but I'll tell you specifically why, especially a person that would have to ask the question, it's not what I would recommend as a primary defensive tool. She's also interested in getting a gun. I think that's a much better solution. I will give a non-lethal alternative and why I would recommend that over a knife for a female in this situation, especially a new mom, which this gal is. Before we get to that, let's go ahead and remind you guys of a way you can help support this show and you can gain a great education. I have a website called homefoodsystems.com where we have courses that you can take on homesteading, permaculture, regenerative agriculture, things like that. We are just about finished with the cover crop and soils course, but you can't buy it just yet. But if you haven't done so yet, you can take the bioreactor compost course. We're heading into fall. If you haven't taken this course yet, get it done so that you can get your compost made and have it this time next year. It takes a year to make this kind of compost, and you want to get started on it as soon as possible, and this is the time to do it. I like to make my compost in the fall because it's more comfortable and it's a good time to clean out a chicken coop. You can make it from a lot of different materials, and you can also take another course there. And the other course there is the principle-based permaculture design course. And here's the best part about that course. It is 100% free. That's right. You can take that course for free. All you got to do is go to homefoodsystems.com, register with the site. You got to register before you can do anything. And then once you do that, you can just sign up for that course, and you take the whole course for free. You get the exams, the course materials, the lessons, the certification at the end of it if you care about that, all of it for $0 in. It's a really great course. When I got done with it, I'm like, man, I thought this was going to be easy and totally worth doing for free. And I'm glad we did it, and I'm glad it's free. But it's why we don't have two paid courses out right now. It's like why we're not done with the cover crop course just yet, but we will be soon. So when I got done with it, the reason I felt that was I'm like, man, I could have charged $30-$40 for this course, and no one would have complained. I probably could have charged $60. And you can get it for free. And I'm going to tell you something about principle-based design, and that's why I did it. Principles are agnostic to things like your location. They're agnostic to your climate. They're agnostic to your rainfall levels. They don't matter. None of that matters to principles. Principles are how we form the concept of design regardless of the environment, how big your yard is, what your solar aspect is. Principles are universal. And that's why I built that course on David Holdrum, co-founder of Permaculture's 12 Permaculture Principles. We bring a lot of things in from Bill Mollison into that course and Jeff Lawton as well. And again, it's 100% free at where? HomeFoodSystems.com. With that, let's go ahead and get into the show. Let's lead off hearing from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini on why democracy isn't the magical word that makes everything right all by itself.
And now today, Chris, we want to start our talk about democracy, because we hear it, especially during this campaign. You know, if I listen to it, it really disgusts me, to tell you the truth. You hear these people that no more have a desire or an understanding of what personal liberty is all about. They don't have any desire and understanding about what really the founders tried to do and what the Constitution says. De Tocqueville, you know, talked about democracy, and he said that what we were doing, this was, I believe, in the 1850s. He says, if we continue to do this and overemphasize democracy, that you will have a dictatorship of the majority. And by people, and I would say, and by people who pretend they care about the minority. They're always the champions of minority, and they get away with it.
Yes, democracy gives the illusion that we, quote unquote, are the government, which is obviously not true if somebody just takes a quick second to think about it. Just think about during the COVID lockdowns, and if you went out of business because your small business, not the big business, if your small business was locked down, you have to be shut down, and you ended up going out of business, did you do that to yourself? Because if you are the government, then you did it to yourself. You have no one to blame. If you were forced to take those jabs that you didn't want, because you didn't want to lose your job, because you were in the government, in the military, in the health sector, but you didn't want to lose everything, and you didn't want it, and just to hear, oops, not sorry, you'll never hear sorry, but oops, let's move on, that didn't work. Mm-hmm. Did you do that to yourself? If you're the government, you did it to yourself. You have no one but yourself to blame. So this is the big illusion of democracy. And of course, we're not the government. But I'm telling you, people believe that we are. I can't tell you how many times throughout my life I have heard, well, that's what you get. This is what we voted for. This is what the people want. Even after, like Dr. Paul mentioned, all those shady elections, and the last one was shady, but there have been many before that. People still think this is the peak. This is the end of history. There's nothing better than this. Everything else is dictatorial tyranny. And that people do believe this stuff, no matter what happens to them. This is not what the American founders set up at all. Perhaps it would be it's time to reconsider what they set up and where everything went wrong.
It's all a charade, and unfortunately, it's enticing. And they're always wanting to solve problems that are there, but they're usually problems they created or their allies have created, but it gives them a chance to perpetuate the system, and some of them like big government, and it's a tool for making the government bigger.
Here's a question to think about. Who are you actually voting for if you're voting? Is it the person that you see? Are you really voting for Kamala or even Trump, you know, for that matter? Or is it all the people behind the scenes that are never up for election, yet they're always there? You don't see them. You don't know them. They know that you don't know them. They know that you only see the person that you're voting for. So these are things to think about. Think of the agencies. Big Pharma and the FDA. Think about what happened with COVID. You know, it's a revolving door. They're part of, you know, these big companies, and then they're part of the government agencies that supposedly regulates these big companies, and we see how that works out. And it's not just Big Pharma. That's just the latest sting of it's all of the industries. That's why big corporations, they love this. This is the ideal for them because they're on the out, they're a part of their companies one day, and then they're a part of the government the other, and then they could go back and forth. It's called a revolving door. Nobody's voting for any of this, and it's unconstitutional. These agencies should not exist. They were created, and they should not exist. They should all be abolished, every one of them. You know, and then think about when the person is in power. Trump wanted to do something, and the next day, one of his underlings would come out, yeah, that's not going to happen. The president misspoke. You know, he wanted $5 billion for a wall, and the government can waste $5 billion before I'm done this sentence, and they wouldn't give him that $5 billion. Yet Biden sends $200 billion to Ukraine. Gone. It's up in smoke. Ukraine is destroyed. You know, so it just shows you where the real power is. Is it the person you're voting for, the one that's trotted out in front of you and you're waving all your signs? You know, it doesn't look that way. I mean, take a look at Biden's mental health. Is he the one running the show? Does anybody really believe that? I don't think so. Based on how they replaced him real quick with Kamala, I don't think so. So these are key questions to think of.
So I completely agree with all that. I actually recorded about a 5-minute response to this and then threw it away. You don't need to hear me bitch about this. The reality is just really, really simple. The problem with democracy is that it is always tyranny of the majority. That's always what it is. And nothing you do will ever prevent that. What you can do is mitigate it. And in our Republican system of government, the founders put a lot of things in to mitigate it. But over time, those were eroded as government used whatever power was given to get bigger and give itself more power. And it is very easy to influence large groups of people through propaganda. And, you know, people say the founders couldn't foresee fully semi-automatic guns, right? Some stupid shit like that. Yeah, they could, because we had repeating firearms all the way back when the founders did. They just weren't common. But what the founders probably really couldn't perceive or foresee is the amount of propaganda capable in a society that is connected the way ours is. Because what we have today when it comes to, like, the internet, cable television, etc., that's something they couldn't understand that was going to happen. They really couldn't. I'm sure they knew something, but they could not know how powerful it was. I think if they had, they would have put even more restrictions upon government. Anyway, moving on, let's hear from Matt Hill over at Start9 about how you can develop apps for the Start9 ecosystem, if that's you, and about using something called FreeGPT and why you might want to.
Hi, this is Matt Hill with Start9, responding to a couple of questions submitted to the Survival Podcast. First question, what is the difference between FreeGPT-2 in the Start9 marketplace and Ollama? Second question, what is the process for contributing apps to the Start9 marketplace? First question first, what is the difference between FreeGPT-2 in the Start9 marketplace and Ollama? FreeGPT-2 in the Start9 marketplace is Ollama on the back end, and it is open web UI on the front end. In other words, FreeGPT-2 is the combination of two different open source projects, Ollama, which is the engine for actually running the large language models, and open web UI, which is the user interface served in the browser that the user uses to interact with the Ollama back end. Open web UI is almost pixel for pixel, the ChatGPT web interface. So when you run FreeGPT-2 on your StartOS server, you are effectively getting the same user experience of using ChatGPT in the browser, except it is your website, and you are communicating to your own back-end large language model server. Second question, what is the process for contributing apps to the Start9 marketplace? We have a packaging documentation on our website, as well as a developer SDK that is very accessible and anyone can use to identify a piece of software that exists in the world and package it and make it available for Start OS. Once that process is complete, and it varies in complexity from service to service, some services are very easy to get packaged for Start OS and others are more difficult, then Start 9 as a team will determine whether we officially want to support the service or whether we want to have it listed on the community registry. In order to go on the official Start 9 registry, it means that we would have to audit the package to make sure that it was code sound and no malware was being included, for example. We would have to test the package. We would have to personally be familiar with the software such that we could provide support for it. And lastly, we would need to agree with it ideologically. If any of those do not align, then we would simply list it on the community registry, and that's where users could go to then discover and install it. It is worth noting that we have a new version of Start OS imminent, and the process for packaging software for the new Start OS is dramatically different than the existing process. It is far more powerful and also far easier. So if you are considering packaging something for Start OS, I definitely suggest waiting for us to officially release the new developer documentation and SDK, as it will make your life a lot easier and also give you a lot more options and flexibility when packaging the software. Thank you.
Great stuff from Matt, and as I said, I did ask him if he wants to be a permanent member of the expert council. While, of course, he's well-versed on everything Start 9, he's pretty good tech expert on top of everything else, because you can't not be one of those if you're going to build something like the Start 9 system. Anyway, let's talk about thermal optics for predator hunting with Mike Molito.
Hey, guys, this question is from John from West Tennessee. He's asking about thermal scopes, especially for predator hunting. He's got a, let's say, entry-level thermal scope, and he's wondering if it's worth it to jump way up in price for a more expensive optic for positive ID of his target. He's concerned about maybe when he's coyote hunting, shooting a neighbor's dog or something like that, because he can't ID the target. Now, I've been blessed to use a lot of expensive night vision and thermal optics in the military. Here's the thing. Thermals are really good if you're trying to distinguish warm objects from background noise, i.e. living things from non-living things. They're really good for detecting that kind of what's alive and what's moving. They are not, even if they're really expensive, great for really fine detail on the target. Really good night vision is generally better for the fine detail, but harder to pick out living targets. Hence why a lot of the higher tier people will have the dual tubes, they'll have the night vision, they'll have the thermals to switch in between. Those are really expensive, and that's not what I'm telling you to do. I think your solution here, John, is simpler. I think stay with the optic you have, mount a good, much cheaper than the $2,000 you mentioned, by far cheaper, maybe a tenth the price, mount a really good white light on your rifle. Once you call that coyote in, and he's within range, light him up with your white light. I don't care how good your thermal is, you're going to have a real hard time distinguishing between a coyote and a coyote-sized dog, like a neighbor's Australian Shepherd, through thermals. You can pick it up with the thermals, call it in with your Fox Pro or your mouth call, whatever you're using, call in the coyote with that, light him up with your white light, take that half a second, which will probably stop anyway because you're shining a light in his eyes, take that half a second to get the PID, that positive identification of your target, which no matter how good your thermal or your night vision is, it's not going to be as good as you observing it with your own eyes with white light, and then make your shot. Sometimes taking a step back in technology is useful. I'm not saying you won't get better quality and somewhat better attributes in higher end thermals. You certainly will. I don't think you're ever going to get what you're looking for by going up in price in thermals. And again, I think for you, your best solution is running a thermal as you have and getting a good weapons-mounted white light on your rifle. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Jack, for having me on. Happy hunting, and have a blessed day.
So I responded to the email that this attachment came with to Mike, and I said, tune in and listen to my story about not taking a shot at a fox, because you answered this question perfectly. So about 5 years ago, I had a fox that was hunting my ducks, and I went out at night, and I had borrowed some night vision from a friend. Now, this wasn't a night vision scope. This was a nice night vision optic. But I could then look through the scope through the optic is the way that worked. And along the back of my property is a little pond that I tried to establish that's failed. And there's like a breast and pile of rocks on the back side of it. And when I looked out there, I could see the eyes of this fox, the green glow of the eyes. And I got a perfect bead on it. And I actually gave it a little bit of a whistle like that, and it stood up. And for half a second, I thought to myself, I don't know if that is that fox or my cat named Fox. Now, a fox and a cat have a pretty good size differential, not as much as a lot of people think. Foxes aren't that big, but they're longer. But from the angle and the front-on look, and with my depth perception is absolutely nothing with NVGs, because I only got one eye and I've got vision issues and all. And I just wasn't sure. So I ended up not taking the shot, and I called the cat, and the cat would have come to me, and instead what this thing did was haul ass. And I'm about 99% it was the fox. I do not regret not taking that shot. I don't want to kill my animal, and I don't want to kill somebody else's animal. And that was with NVGs, and it was not an ideal situation. With thermal, I've used quite a few different thermal optics, and some are definitely better than others. A lot of times it feels like you're looking at a cartoon in them. They're very effective, but you cannot positively ID, you know, a border collie versus a coyote in one. So the idea, and I was, when I heard this question, this was exactly the direction my mind went in. Get a high-end NVG optic that is in, you know, not a scope, just a standalone, kind of like I had on that night, and the thermal scope, and then use predator calls. That is a well thought out and absolutely perfect answer, and I thank him for it. Let's move on and talk about exercising today in our middle age to avoid injury tomorrow in our elder age with Andy McCann.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, and CrossFit Garage. So I have a podcast called Fitness, Food, and Finances, CrossFit Garage, so it's pretty easy to find. And I take these questions that y'all give me, and I expand on them in that podcast, and I do other stuff. But if you want more details, go there. I only have about 7 minutes or less to talk to you here. So James has got a great question today. He said, Jack, been listening to your show for over 8 years now. Keep up the great work. Love it. Below, I have multiple questions for various people and your expert counsel. Andy McCann, what are some exercises someone in their mid-40s can do to help prevent injuries later in life? Details. I'm a 44-year-old, 6'2", and about 200 pounds. I guess you could say I'm skinny fat, or I have a dad bod. Nice. I have a couple small free weights and a Peloton bike for home equipment. I'm looking to lose a bit of weight, but mainly do preventative maintenance on my body to help keep me healthy as I get older. Okay, so there's a couple things in this question, and I know I read that poorly. I'm a little dyslexic, so reading out loud is not great for me. But his main question is, what can I do to prevent injury? So I'm going to go into that with just the idea of, hey, you're 40, you're going to get older. How do you prevent injury, and what do you do? And what I'm going to end with is, he's got some gear, so I'm going to give some ideas just on specifically your gear. But I also have this document that I wrote up during that time when we were all supposed to go home for 2 weeks. It's called 32 At-Home Workouts. And it's just, you know, because there's you know, 31 days in the month, so I gave you 32. So anyway, I'm going to put this link, this document back over to Jack, and he can put it in the show notes if he wants. It's pretty easy. It's workouts you can do at home with no equipment. There is a donate if you'd like me to, like, build up on this or do more with it, or just use it and share it. I don't care. There's no royalties or anything on that. But if you want to throw some Venmo or PayPal or Cash App at me, I'm not going to say no. And I'll start doing stuff to make this thing get beefed up. But anyway, I'll put this in the show notes. You guys can have it. And to go specifically to your question, you kind of first have to figure out what are the biggest things that older people are going to face in terms of injuries. And if you do a quick Google search, you're going to find these out. But it's pretty obvious. I think everyone would know these. You're going to fall. Actually, as a matter of fact, if you can make it to 76, then if you fall, I think your chances of dying go up by 30% when you fall and break your hip. So don't fall and break your hip. So first thing is we follow coordination balance. It's really just do anything and keep moving and pushing yourself a bit. But I'm going to give you specific stuff. So your bones get weaker. So what could you do there? Just simply lift. You don't use your joints enough. So you use your joints. I know, weird, right? Overuse, and it's usually not like a workout overuse. It's like overuse in a very repetitive task. Like you're always, I don't know, screwing down something in the chicken coop or whatever. You're always using a wrench or you're always using a screwdriver. So those are probably the biggest things. There are some other things that may come up, but you said, you know, injuries, and it's typically going to be, I lost my coordination, I tripped and fell. I don't have much bone density, and there's a problem there, and my joints don't really feel great. What do I do? Or maybe like an arthritis, and these things will help kind of get you out of that. So what should you do? First thing I'd always lean into is strength training. And you're like, wait, I thought it's just go for a walk. You're like, no, I would do some strength training. I would do anything to get that strength up. It doesn't have to be complicated. I've talked about thrusters before where you're in a squat and then you stand up and then press something above your head. That's going to be great. It's going to have lots of joint movement. And you can go fast, you can go slow, you can go heavy, you can go light. There's a lot of ways you can do this. But some of the easier ones would be squat, deadlift, and maybe even bench press. Just some basic power movements to build strength. If you're only going to do one, I would probably pick the back squat, maybe the deadlift, but I just like the back squat more. It's got, I like squatting below parallel. It gives you a bit more longevity, so I would go for a back squat. I know, I think you said in the gear write-up that you had small dumbbells and a Peloton. So there are biking. I do like biking because it's very low impact, but it can move all your joints. So you can add that into your workout regimen. And again, constantly varied functional movements executed at high intensity or CrossFit. And I say high intensity sometimes, it's going to hit all those things. So constantly varied, just keep it moving. Don't always do the same thing. Don't get stuck in a routine. And do things that you would be doing anyway. So I probably wouldn't do like Romanian deadlift or Bulgarian split squat. I don't know. I mean, actually, that does have some use, but I probably wouldn't do those things. The other side of it is as you're getting older, you're going to lose your balance and coordination. So I would probably do some things that would add to that, which actually might be some reverse lunges. I don't know if I would do the Bulgarian split squat. You have to go look that up. But some lunges would be good. That's going to help you keep that balance as well as have that range of motion. And you could do it with weights. Another one that's pretty functional and easy to do is a step up. So you can either get a box or just use your stairs and go up and go down. I think you want to kind of push the maximal sides. So don't go over the limit. So don't go like to one rep max or the tallest box you can do. But find where your point is. So lift your knee up. Where does it go naturally? Then make it a little bit higher so you have to stretch for it. So again, going back to back squat for strength, deadlift possibly if you could do that. You've got some dumbbells. So thrusters are great. It's going to get you below parallel. It's going to use all your joints. You're going to have a hip explosion. You're going to go above your head. I mean, it's a great movement. You've got your Peloton, so I'd be biking on that and maybe mix that in with what I'm doing. So I might use the thruster or the dumbbells as my slow movement, just kind of get some strength in there, and then jump on the Peloton and do like, hey, I'm going to do 20 seconds of hard work, 10 seconds of light work. 20 seconds of hard work, and that's a Tabata-style movement. Another one is those lunges or the step-ups. Let me think about another one for you. Okay, so you also mentioned in the details that you would actually like to lose weight or you have a dad bod. I think what you're trying to say there is at 6'2 and 200 pounds, that's actually, yeah, so you're not like fat, or I wouldn't consider that fat. We'd have to see how the makeup is. But something you could do that's pretty easy is a suitcase carry or a farmer's carry. I would probably lean towards a suitcase carry because it makes you engage your other side. So it's going to help prevent some of these. It's going to go less towards just strength and more towards some of the coordination, which you are going to lose as you get older. So a farmer's carry, think about them carrying, 2 gallons on each side, 1 gallon in each hand and walking. Well, the suitcase carry is just one. So it's just a suitcase that you're walking with. You're going to to hold it about an inch away from your body, and you're going to take nice robotic steps. Just go down, I don't know, maybe like 30 feet, turn around and come back, and then switch hands. And you don't want to go too heavy on this. What you're going to find is that's going to not only strengthen up the side you're holding, but also the other side because of the asymmetric style of it. So I would add that in there. Again, if you want more information, I'm going to turn this into a full-blown podcast where I talk a little slower and add some weird anecdotes from my life.
And the write-up he mentioned, I do have a link to it in the show notes for today's show. If you go to our episode today, which is 3550, you will find it right next to Andy's bullet point. It'll say 32 at-home workouts. Next up, let's hear about making sure that you haven't been hacked and preventing hacks of your Bitcoin wallet on your computer and some different things you can do to prevent that from Jesse Markowitz.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz from yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Today, I have a question from Alan about: how can you know your computer is safe from hackers and apps so you can check your cold storage or do transfers? Yes, Norton 360, but never really feel safe enough to put the USB in to check the balances or make transfers to other cold storage. I don't have all the details, so I made some assumptions. Alan, if I misunderstood something or you have more details, feel free to let me know and I can dive a bit deeper for you. It sounds like you're working with Bitcoin and cold storage using a hardware wallet that connects to your computer via USB. For folks not familiar with the term, cold storage means that the keys to control the Bitcoin are stored in a hard-to-access protected manner, generally in a hardware wallet, special-purpose hardware not connected to the Internet. Before I answer the question, how do I know if my computer is safe from hackers, let's first talk about checking Bitcoin balances. To check your balance, you just need the address or addresses of the Bitcoin in your cold storage. There's no need for any device to be plugged in. Now, if the only place you have the addresses are on the device, it might be easier to plug it in to copy the address. But it's not critical. When checking the balance on a Bitcoin address, you're perfectly safe from theft. There's no risk to your funds by checking a blockchain explorer such as mempool.space to look up an address to see how much Bitcoin are on that address. There is, however, a potential risk to your privacy. If you do not run your own block explorer, it's possible for whoever runs that explorer to connect the address that you check with your IP address and browser information. So, depending upon how closely your IP address and browser information is tied to you personally, it may be more or less of a concern. For most people, it's not a concern at all. But if you are very privacy-focused, you might prefer to avoid connecting your Bitcoin addresses with anything that might get traced back to you. If you're interested in more privacy, investigate using a Tor, T-O-R, browser, or, better yet, run your own Bitcoin node in Block Explorer so your queries are entirely private. Internet-connected devices such as computers and phones that are used for many purposes are more likely to be compromised by computer viruses or other malware. Using a hardware wallet keeps your Bitcoin keys off of those devices. When it's time for the program on your computer to send Bitcoin to someone, it'll create a transaction. The external hardware wallet will take that transaction and let you cryptographically sign it. Then your computer can take that signed transaction and send it to the Bitcoin network so your Bitcoin can be transferred. Often, the way that the unsigned and signed transactions are transferred is by a USB cable connecting your hardware device to the computer. If your computer is hacked and it changes the destination that the Bitcoin would be sent to, or the amount of Bitcoin being sent, you would see that on your hardware device, and you can choose not to sign it. If, after signing the transaction, your computer changes something, the signature will no longer be valid, and that transaction won't be processed by anyone else. This is how your hardware wallet protects your Bitcoin, even if your computer has been hacked. If you want to be even more secure, you can use a hardware device that never plugs into the computer at all. Some hardware wallets support transferring data not via USB, but by NFC, near field communication, or via camera and using QR codes. One of the hardware wallets I use, ColdCard, never gets plugged into my computer, ever. Instead, I use a micro SD card to transfer the transaction between my computer and wallet. Be aware that seed phrases, the 12 or 24 words that can be used to recover all your Bitcoin keys, need to be protected. Using a hardware wallet, but having your seed phrase unprotected in a text file on your computer is just asking for trouble. So, after all that, the short answer is, funds are safe when you're viewing balances. When transferring Bitcoin, make sure to confirm everything on your hardware wallet screen, and you're safe from the vast majority of attacks. Now, back to the original question. How do I know that my computer is safe? The bad news is, without taking wildly extreme measures, you cannot be 100.0% sure. The good news is, if you're not being targeted by very well-trained, well-funded hackers, doing the following three things will get you to 99% sure. Number one, visually inspect your computers and network hardware, looking for any device that you do not expect to be there. Any unexpected device should be investigated closely. If there are USB cards that are stuck in that you're not aware of, you should look into those. They actually make keyloggers, small devices, cost less than $50, that connect via USB between your keyboard and computer that will record every single keystroke from your keyboard. So even if data is encrypted on your computer, when you type in passwords or stuff like that, those keyloggers would actually capture that information. If your keyboard is plugged into the back of your computer and someone puts one of these keyloggers there, it's very easy to miss. So number one, visually inspect your computers, look for hardware. Number two, make sure you have security software like Norton 360. Make sure it's up to date. Make sure it's running. Number three, look for anything unexpected while using your computer. Slowing response time, hard drive filling up, higher than expected network usage, camera in the use light turning on by itself, new browser plugins or extensions, changes to your homepage, anything along those lines. Those are indicators that there may be issues with your computer. This is Jesse Markowitz from Your Personal Bitcoin Assistant. I hope this has been helpful. I love learning, teaching people about technology, particularly Bitcoin, Lightning, self-hosting software, and other technology issues. Send some questions into Jack, and I'll get them answered for you here. Thank you very much.
And I'm just going to add that I'm all for effective security and good general practices. And it doesn't even have to have anything to do with Bitcoin. There's plenty of people that would like access to your computer. I do want to throw out a fundamental reality that I think a lot of people are just not in touch with, though. You're not that important. You know, if you have a few million dollars worth of Bitcoin, you might want to think about some added levels of security, multi-sig and something like that. But the people that generally seem to be the most concerned about this, when you ask them how much Bitcoin they have like $700 worth. I honestly, if I only had $7 worth of Bitcoin, and I had a computer, and I was using even just a plain software wallet with it, I would probably be more concerned about the data on the computer than the $700. And one of the reasons that we tell you, because the least secure location, in my opinion, for your Bitcoin is on an exchange, right? Like on Coinbase or anybody. Because if I'm a hacker, where do I want to get into? I want to get into the database of an exchange which has all the keys, right? I want all the Bitcoin. I want all of the shit coins. I want it all. I want your name and your social security number. I want as much information I can get on as many people as possible. That's where the effort goes. So just by being an individual, you're already in a much better situation than you would be if you were on an exchange. I do say once you're over a few thousand dollars, look at getting a good hardware wallet. Learn how to use it. Learn how to back it up. Do not stick it in your box and leave it there forever. Take it out every couple weeks. Plug it in. See if it needs any updates or anything on it. But the only time that anything can be seen at all across your internet connection on that wallet is when it's plugged in, and then it has a second layer of security on top of the security itself. I like Trezor, and I like the Exodus as the software wallet to pair with it. It ends up giving you a double layer of protection. I'm not saying it's the best. It's very good, though. And I don't want to be your customer service. So what I know about Exodus is if you have a problem on the Exodus side, they have customer support that's actually good. And on the Trezor side, they have customer support that's actually good. So that's why I recommend those. But I do recommend a hardware wallet once you get over a few grand. You know, but if you look at like a good hardware wallet, it's going to cost about $200. If you have $200 worth of Bitcoin, I'm not going to put a $200 insurance policy that costs me $200 on $200. So I think we take those. If I have a few hundred dollars, honestly, even up to a couple thousand dollars in Bitcoin, I have no problem using a good, high-quality software wallet like Exodus for that. After that, I want to start looking at that added layer of security. It's just not... I think what happens is people are a little bit afraid that it's going to be hard. You know, just get it. Follow the instructions. You know, move a little bit of money onto it before you move all the money. And once you do it, you'll realize there's nothing to be afraid of. You already did more than most people because you own enough Bitcoin to care. So you got past that fear hurdle. Get past that. The steps are get a way where you can buy it, get yourself a software wallet, and get that shit off the exchange, and then secure it at a higher level. I have a link in the show notes today, Nesta Jesse's segment. It's an article I wrote on the basics of Bitcoin self-custody, and if you haven't read it yet, you may want to check it out. And if you have, you may want to read it again. Next up, I thought this was a great question. Next, guy has got himself a hold of some Starlink equipment, and he's going mobile with it, and he's got a generator so he can run it as much as he wants. Generators are noisy and all. He wants to build a battery backup for it, and he wants to know how much battery you need to run it for a full day, and maybe add solar to that. Sean Mills, of course, is who I would go to for that information.
Hey, everybody. It's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and today I've got a question from Joseph. How much battery would I need to run a Starlink for a day? I'm going to be working out of cell phone service for several weeks with my crew. I just ordered a Starlink so that we could at least have communication while without driving back into cell range. We don't have permanent power at the location, but we do have a generator. My plan right now is to turn on the generator and run the Starlink for an hour or two each night, but I was wondering if there would be any feasible option for having a battery that I can charge up with the generator and then run the Starlink for a longer period of time. Well, Joseph, I have Starlink. Now, I have like the Gen 2 model. I don't know if all of the modems are exactly the same, but I will tell you that mine draws about 90 watts per hour when it's on. It fluctuates a little bit. I guess, you know, there's some communication happening, and so that'll fluctuate up a little bit. But on average, it draws about 90 watts when it's when it's plugged in. So, you know, let's just round that up to 100 for easy math and say in a 24-hour period, you would need 2,400 watt-hours of stored energy in order to, you know, keep that Starlink up and going, you know, 24/7. So let's talk about what you might need to do that. Most of your batteries in the, when I say batteries, I'm talking about what everyone else refers to as a solar generator. I don't like that term because it doesn't actually generate anything. A solar panel is a solar generator, but don't let me get off on my soapbox there. I would say most of the medium-sized ones are going to have enough storage to do what you want, and you could plug them right into a generator to charge them up. You could also plug them into, you know, solar panels during the day and have them charge up off of the solar panels. So I would suggest something in the 2,500 to 3,500 watt range. Now, one thing to remember is that the solar tax credit, or rather the investment tax credit that applies to battery banks without solar. So if you just did battery, you have to have at least 3,000 watt hours in order to claim the tax credit. So you probably want to look at something where you're up in that 3,000 to 5,000 range, because then 30% of your device is paid for by the government. So that's nice. There are a few models out there. I like the DIY approach. Like, I don't know if you've seen my videos about building your own Delta Pro, but they're on YouTube, and you know, for way less than the cost of a Delta Pro, I can build something that's got similar characteristics, and it comes in a big toolbox that's weatherproof that you can put in the bed of your truck and leave out on a job site, and et cetera, et cetera. So you might want to check that out. But even if you were to buy something off the shelf, as long as you're over that 3,000 watt-hour range, A, you get the tax credit, and B, you can use that to run your Starlink for 24 hours, you know, and then all you would need to do would be to charge that up. So if you're charging it up off of a regular 15 amp plug in a generator, that when that generator is running, you're going to be able to put about 1,800 watt hours per hour into the battery. So in general, if you were to run your generator for 2 hours with your Starlink and your battery pack plugged into it, you could then turn around and run your Starlink off that battery pack, plus charge phones and some other light power usage things for, you know, the next day. And so every day you would run the generator for a couple hours, charge everything back up, and then you'd be good to go. You didn't say where you were, but generally in the United States, you can count on about 4 sun hours per day. Now, of course, that gets worse the further north you are and the more in the winter you are. But if you're in an area where you could actually charge this up with solar panels, you know, something as small as about 500 to 600 watts of solar, you know, could easily be plugged into this device. And then it could charge up on its own during the day. And then you come back from the job site, plug your Starlink in, and you're good to go. So I hope that answered your question. Like I said, I have not dealt with the mobile units or the new mini unit that's out there. But I do know that my standard Starlink draws 90 watts an hour, and so you can kind of base everything off of that. All right, guys, keep getting those questions in to Jack, and I'll keep getting them answered.
Great answer from Sean. I have nothing much to add because why would I? He's the professional in that world. Next up, I have a question for Ken Daniels on making blackberry-infused vodka.
Hello again. This is Ken from DrinkEatLearn.com. Our question comes from Jason in Oregon. Jason asks, any ideas to improve blackberry-infused vodka? Himalayan blackberries are truly my arch nemesis. However, when I'm losing the battle, which is most years, the berries are at peak ripeness are something very special. Our favorite thing to do with them is to infuse vodka. We fill jars with berries and simply fill up with decent vodka, usually from Costco, which I feel is pretty close to Grey Goose. It's good after about 4 weeks, but better at 3 to 4 months. Seems strange, but freezing the berries really detracts from the flavor. We put up a gallon or two each year and give some out as Christmas presents. It is good straight, but we typically cut it with a little tonic or clear soda. I'd like to try something new with some of it. Not concerned about cost or time. Any ideas? Thanks for your question, Jason. I feel like your first way to upgrade your infusion would be to upgrade to a higher ABV. Everclear would be my choice. I wouldn't be afraid of the flavor difference in vodka and Everclear. The extraction to me is more important. In fact, I rarely use expensive or high-quality spirits for general infusions. If you'd like to keep the vodka, just aim for the highest proof that you can find. And since you're looking to enhance the blackberry intensity, the higher the proof of the alcohol, the better the extraction. I personally would use the sous vide technique to extract, I think about 135 degrees at about 4 to 6 hours. Taste along the way, but this will certainly make things quicker. You can certainly keep the longer jar method, but I would increase the ABV for the alcohol. Your timing, 3 to 4 months, is about right. I'm not sure the current jar ratio you use to infuse, but I prefer 1 to 1. 1 cup blackberries, 1 cup alcohol. The blackberry ratio is high in this recipe, but I use something like Everclear. The higher proof means you can stretch the alcohol further by proofing it down with distilled water, using the higher proof to expel more flavor, then bringing it down to a more drinkable ABV. There are some great calculators online to help you do this. With either technique, adding in vanilla bean, cardamom, cinnamon, clove, ginger, even rosemary can add flavors just beyond the blackberry. Also, if your harvest isn't great and the blackberries are intensely tart, you can add some sugar, honey, or agave during your infusion to balance the flavors. I hope I answered your topic about the infusion. Let's talk about some fun alternatives. First, you could use some high-proof, over 100% ABV whiskey, rum, or gin for the infusion. Now, this does change with the original vodka question, but I do recommend the variation. There's a big craze for blackberry spirits right now, and depending on your harvest size, you could make several types of alcohol infusions to see which you like best. Secondly, you can infuse vinegar instead of vodka, and I recommend one of the many recipes online. You could find a small batch and just make some with your other alcohol infusions. And I know many people that would love to receive homemade blackberry vinaigrette as a gift. Third, I am a huge advocate for making blackberry wine. Infusions are wonderful, but if you've never tried home brewing, there's no better time than now. I suggest re-listening to Jack's episode 1684 and 1694. It's simply a great way to get started. Those two episodes are two that I come back to as a refresher course time and time again. And if you're willing to invest the time in learning this trade, it's super fun and can greatly expand what you can do with anything that you harvest. Lastly, you guys know me, I'll always add a cooking component. This was a topic I had planned to feature in the future, but I can sneak peek it here, and the concept is called fat washing. Expect a more detailed how-to in the coming future. So fat washing infuses oils and fats into alcohol, and this can range from tallow, bacon fat, brown butter, olive oil, sesame oil, duck fat. It's pretty endless. And you can use these base fats, or you could add some flavor stacking by adding herbs or spices into the fat, and you've got flavor exponentially enhanced. This technique is simple, but it does take some instruction. The food science technique adds this rich, silky, umami flavor and textures without the greasiness. And there's a ton more to learn about fat washing, and it's a strange food science concept for both cocktails and food. We can go more in depth for a future segment, or just contact me at drinkeatlearn.com. Okay, so to quickly finish this concept, I'd make some brown butter or bacon fat, and I'd slowly toast in some dried cinnamon, nutmeg, and dried orange peel right into the fat. I would use the blackberry-infused rum you previously made. I would fat wash these two together. Then I would take this intense infusion and make a Christmas rum cake, then pair it with some blackberry-infused vodka rum or bourbon. It would make for a memorable gift if you can resist the urge to not eat it yourself. I hope I've given you some ideas on how to improve your infusion and possibly add some other ideas. Keep your questions coming, and until next time, this is Ken Daniels with DrinkEatLearn.com. Cheers.
So I really like the idea of adding other flavor enhancements to the vodka after the infusion is made. And I agree with the higher proof you use, the better the infusion you're going to get. I would also say that, you know, a white rum is really great for this in addition to vodka. Because if you do a white rum, you have a perfect high proof to work with in Bacardi 151. It's actually a fairly neutral spirit. The only thing that really makes a white rum much different than a vodka is it has more residual sugars left in it, which will pair really nice with the blackberry infusion. The rum is just not stripped out. Like 151, about as high as you can go before you really start stripping out any of the flavors, no matter what it was made with. Because I can make a straight up rum with sugar, and I can make a straight up rum with or a straight up vodka with sugar, and the vodka will be a completely neutral spirit. And the rum, the only difference is I'm not going to run it as hard or as many times. I'm not going to either run it through, you know, a column still where I come straight at it like 190 and then dilute it down with distilled water like I would a vodka. Or if I don't have that capability with vodka, if I'm going to make it, I'm just going to run it multiple runs until it's fully neutral and I've taken all of those esters out of it. That's the only real difference with rum, unless we age it or unless it's made with like blackstrap molasses or something like that. Now, the recommendation for vanilla and blackberry are buddies. They are friends. And the last thing I'll say before I move on to my segment is that when you heard him talk about making wine and the two episodes that I've done on making wines, mead, small batch ciders, all that stuff, as good as a straight blackberry wine is, a blackberry mead is something really special. And if you make it so it's, you know, a 14 to 16% alcohol by volume mead, which if you use the yeast blend I recommend, you can definitely do that no problem. It ages sublimely. And it is, mead is excellent and blackberry wine is excellent, but a blackberry mead, a Melomel, is something all to itself. When I've made it here, everybody that's tried it has absolutely loved it. All right, let's go on with my segment today. And this is an interesting one, and it's one that you're like, how do I say don't do this and not sound mean or not sound like I'm talking down because the person asking is a woman through a man anyway? Well, Dennis Allen, a.k.a. City Boy Homestead, who's been on the show, said, what is a good knife for a single woman with a baby or another way for her to defend herself? She travels the U.S. a lot via automobile and needs to protect herself from unavoidable creeps. She is also interested in getting a handgun. I'm going to start off with, I will never tell anybody not to carry a knife. I think everybody should carry a knife, male, female, trans female, trans male, I don't care what you are. And it, definitely guys, I kind of like when the dude's like, I don't carry a knife, you got your knife? And then you're like, yeah, here. And they go, why do you carry a knife? You're like, oh, you just roll your eyes. Like, whatever has made people afraid to carry knives needs to go away and die. Different locations have different restrictions on blade length and stuff like that. You know, a knife that's completely legal in Texas will make you a felon in Massachusetts. Okay? So know what those are that carry a knife that works for you, that carries knives, that's good quality, that you like. And for most people, that's all I'm going to recommend with a knife. You know, your budget, your preference, your legal situation. And this is why a knife is an incredibly effective tool. It's a defensive or an offensive weapon. It also requires training, and it requires a level of aggression that most people do not have for it to be used well. And when you're being attacked, it's probably the case the person that's attacking you has the level of aggression required, and you may not. And so it is very possible in that situation that you get a female or a less aggressive male, number one, draws the knife too early. This is a big mistake. Like, if you're standing 10 feet away from me, and I pull out a snub-nose 38, and I'll talk about how I would do that, especially how I would train this person to do that from 10 feet, and I don't care if you have a knife, and that stupid tooler drill and all that, we're not going to get into it today. That's a different thing. Well, that is when the person has the gun in the holster and the guy has the knife out, all right? Once you're 10 foot away from me and I have a gun pointed at you, it's a different world that we live in. And not everybody's fucking Bruce Lee or Jackie Chan. So let's not do that bullshit, because that's what all these demonstrations are done with as experts. And that guy is afraid that that woman, and actually when somebody's pointing a gun at you, let me tell you something, the more afraid that person is, the more afraid you are, you're going to get shot. You know, my father was held up at a gas station that he owned in Florida twice. And the one time the guy was calm and he didn't see any way, you know, to do anything about it without risking getting shot, so he didn't, but he said he was pretty chill himself the whole time. The second guy that robbed him was shaking, quaking, and jerking his hands around and like, give me the money. Like, and he said that guy, he was afraid he was going to kill him even if he didn't want to. Right, so there is an intimidation factor when there is a bullet with your name on it pointed at your ass. Now, I also concern myself that people may not be willing to use it, and when you produce it, you better be willing to use it. And even for this application with a gun, the issue is if you have a knife or a gun and there's a confrontation, you have a knife fight or a gun fight because you brought the weapon. And that means you need to master its use and be willing to use it. But guns produced in these situations often diffuse the situation without firing a shot. The law may consider it brandishing. I consider it not killing you if I don't have to. Okay? And over, that has happened in most situations. The fact that the gun exists defuses the conflict, because all of a sudden I'm a 200-pound scumbag and it's a 130-pound woman with a baby, but she's leveled a freaking Colt in my direction. The whole calculus in my risk-reward part of my brain just changed. Okay? If she pulls a knife out at that distance, you know what I'm thinking? I'll beat your ass and take that knife from you. Why? The knife requires me to, even though the knife is what's doing the touching, the knife is in my hand, and I have to touch you, which means I have to break distance, and I have to close distance to use it. Or you have to break distance to me, and I have to be ready to defend myself when you do. If I have a gun in that situation, I don't care if you're 10 foot away. As I'm drawing that gun, I'm backing up if there's anywhere to go, and I'm putting another 5 to 10 foot in between me and you. Why? Because if the more I can keep that distance, the more time I have to react if you decide to come after me. Now, I can't get into all the different training that a person that's going to carry a gun should have. You should take, you know, the basic safety course and all that most states make you to get a permit if you need a permit in your state. But you should take at least one good defensive pistol course, at least one. But in that situation, like, the most generic advice I can give is when you draw that gun, I'm going to use a term here that's not an accurate term, but it's kind of like shooting from the hip. But not your old Western movie with a guy fanning a six-shooter and knocking the gun out of four people's hands. Was the funny one, Blazing Saddles, right? And the Waco Kid, right? No. I wonder if they would have called him the Waco Kid if they made that movie after 1996. Probably not. Anyway, what I'm actually talking about, and any good defensive course is going to teach this method, is when that weapon's drawn, let's say right side is your strong side, and you're drawing appendix or hip carry or whatever, when that weapon comes out, your hand with the weapon in it rides your side and kind of hooks in to your belly. And if you do that right now, and you make, like when we were kids, and you made a little gun, like with your thumb up and your finger out, if you do that, and you do what I'm talking about, you look down at it, and you turn your body, do you see what happens? Wherever you point, it points. And all we need to do is put lots of holes in the middle. Okay? So, and you should practice shooting this way, not just assume it'll work, at reasonable defensive distances. And if I'm telling you, I don't care all this bullshit about people still coming after you. Know, if you are a cop and you're shooting at a guy on meth that's trying to kill you, that's one thing. If you're a woman that some guy decided he's going to rape because you stopped at a truck stop or something, you start putting a couple holes in somebody's belly, it changes their whole outlook on life. Right? We can't be prepared for, what if the guy has a bazooka? Then you're fucked, right? So, I mean, you can't be prepared for everything. But I would much rather have this person get a little bit of training and get comfortable with a handgun than think a knife is a valid self-defense tool. We also have to, like, the problem is that people somehow, and there's no reason for it, seem to equate knife with, like, less than lethal defense. A knife is a lethal defense tool, always. It's as lethal as any firearm. There's actually a really high incidence of, if it's a big enough blade and you're stabbed in the torso, the death likelihood is as high or higher than many firearms injuries. A lot of firearms injuries, if you know, we're talking Full Metal Jacket or whatever, if they don't hit an artery right away, even if that person's incapacitated, there's a lot of opportunity to save them. When somebody's stabbed with a sharp blade, that blade does damage in and out. Any bow hunter will tell you how deadly a blade is. You put a four-blade satellite broadhead through a deer, both lungs, and when you gut that deer, those lungs are gone. They're like red globules. So several stab wounds, three stab wounds, if it's done by somebody trained, that knows what they're doing, that knows what cavitation is, it's at least six injuries. Because it's an in and an out. And that sounds vicious. And if you don't want to learn how to do that, then a knife is not the defensive tool. Now, I'm not saying if somebody grabs you and that's what you can get to, you don't stab them in the neck, and it's not going to be effective. Yeah, it's going to be effective. But real knife work is complex and hard, and it's gruesome and it's dirty. Not that shooting somebody's clean, there's just a difference. If you want a less than lethal option here, then I suggest that this person carry and learn to use effectively a very high quality pepper spray. And you need to understand something here, because whenever you say that, well, I had this friend, he was in Special Forces, and they used to put it on their tacos. Yeah, I put freaking Cholula hot sauce on my taco, and I don't want it in my eye. I eat jalapenos like candy, but I always regret it after I cut a bunch of them up to make jalapeno sausage with, and I forget and I touch my face. There's a difference between something going in your mouth and something going in your eyes. And all that needs to be done in that situation is to break contact and get away. You are not a cop. You're not trying to put handcuffs on this person. You want to end the conflict. And so doing what's necessary to incapacitate and then immediately initiate retreat and then call in backup, call 911. That's what you need to be doing in this situation. So I don't have a specific knife recommendation here. I'm back to everybody should carry at least one knife. It should be sharp and well-maintained, and you should know how to use it. And it should be comfortable to carry to the point where you always do. But It is often a very bad choice in defensive tools, even for people that know how to use it. It is a weapon of last resort. And you can show me all the videos of Tooler drills, the 21-foot drills, and all these experts and shit you want to. Yeah, and I'll show you a guy that can take a $3 freaking mini hammer and beat the shit out of 20 guys with it named Doug McCaria. You're not him and neither am I. And that's when we get into these discussions and people get into this minutia. And I'll tell you what, if you're going to write me an email about this and tell me how badass you are with a knife, then you don't need to, because you know that what I'm telling you is the truth. If you really are. If you've actually been to training to learn how to use a knife in these situations and what to do and how to shape your body in that attack. And real knife attacks are almost always ambush attacks. I'm not saying they can't be used for defense, but most injuries with knives are ambush attacks. You want to know what knife attacks look like? Look at prisons. Look at prisons. The person that's being attacked is stabbed 10 times or more before they really figure out what's happening. It's brutal. And it's something that I'm going to tell you, not all, but most women are not going to be capable of. If I was to recommend an edged weapon for a female, it would be a straight razor. Because instead of stabbing, it's a slashing weapon. And when you slash, with one, it opens shit up to the point that once the person that has been hit with it figures it out, they realize they've got a big problem now, okay? A big problem. The issue with, you know, that is also a lot of times that might take multiple hits before they realize what's been done to them. Because when the adrenaline's up and then a razor is already so sharp, a lot of times people don't feel. I had a friend who I worked with when I was a bouncer, and he grabbed a guy who pulled the straight razor out of his pocket and cut the shit out of this dude's hands. And he had him like in a bear hug walking him to the door, and he had been cut like 3 times before he knew he was being cut, and 2 other dudes grabbed him, and I came in behind and grabbed the guy by a chokehold. And then he did not get thrown out. He got put on the ground. And there happened to be a cop in the parking lot, and that was the one time in all of that we actually had the cops take somebody away for assault, and we had to get this other guy off to the ER. He needed major stitches. He had damage to a tendon, a serious damage to a tendon in his left hand. Knives are as deadly as anything else. They are not a lesser weapon, but they require more training and execution to use properly in that situation, and they should be seen by most people as a last line of defense, not a first line of defense. And again, all your assassin movies and that shit, but good pepper spray, good handgun, good training, and knife each has a different purpose and place. That's my recommendation there. I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. Hope you enjoyed this week. I'm going to wrap up now. And just remind you, you know, we didn't have a lot of items of the day this week. We only had 2. We had the Vivor garden beds on sale again. That's why I brought them around. These galvanized garden beds are awesome. You can find them in today's show notes or at T-Spaz. To be able to get a box in the mail shipped to your door that you can pick up in your own 2 hands and walk out in the backyard with, that will make an 8x12 foot or 4x8 foot bed, is pretty awesome. They take a little bit of time to put together because there's so many damn screws to them, but it's not hard. And they come in 1 and 2 foot depths. And I think the 2 foot deep ones are on sale for just over $90 right now. You can't build a 2 foot deep 4x8 raised bed out of, you know, pressure treated 2x6s for that money. You can't do it. I've done the math on it. And it'll last for damn near ever. So check these out. And then the other item of the day this week, what was it? I can't remember. Oh, the Frigidaire portable ice maker. Those are on sale for $87 from Amazon this week. They're pretty badass, and it's simple to use. You plug them in, you fill them up with water. When they run out of water, you add more. When the ice melts, the water goes back, and the reservoir makes more ice. Very low draw, easy to run on backup power, so they're great during a power outage. And they pay for themselves. If you look at what a bag of ice costs today, it's just ridiculous. All it is frozen water. You can freeze it for yourself, so you can check those out. Remember, you always help us out anytime you shop on tspaz.com. Also, I ran an article this week, and I didn't mention it on the air, and I should have. The Self-Reliance Festival is coming October 5th and 6th in Camden, Tennessee. I will be there presenting alongside, you know, Nicole Sauce, John Willis, and some other really, really awesome people. It'll be a great event. It always is. Sean Mills will be there. Joel Riles will be there. Sonny Pazikas. If you've ever wanted to know what it's like to get hit with a Sistema punch, don't ask me to do it. Ask Sonny. He'll hit you. Alan Booker's going to be there. Angry Prepper. C.J. Kilmer. C.J. Kilmer. Professor C.J. is back. He's had took kind of a step back from things for a while to deal with some personal issues, but he's back on the attack. Come check us out. I think you'll really enjoy it. You can find that, more information on it, at thesurvivalpodcast.com or in today's show notes. I wish you well. Hope you enjoyed the week, and we will be back with you tomorrow with a Friday flashback. And then next week, as always, we'll do it all over again. Just run you round. They said you should have a house. The American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.